Good afternoon, everybody. So thanks again for coming to today's installment in the fifth annual SESE lecture series. Before I introduce our speaker, I'd just like to say a word about next week's speaker, Dr. Mahira Yaqub of the Department of World Languages, Literature, and Culture at Nazarbayev University will be speaking about intentional and unintentional use of language and the shift in language identity. I was talking to her about it today. It's going to be a much friendlier talk about different generations and language policy and adaptation. So I look forward to seeing you next week at that talk. Today, fresh in from Ankara, Turkey, we have Timothy Jack Rowe, who is a PhD candidate in the Department of Languages and Cultures of Asia. And God willing, today will be the last day he's Mr. Rowe, and tomorrow hopefully he'll get a promotion. So Jack is from Idaho. He did his undergraduate work at Idaho State University. He later completed a master's degree in Middle Eastern and North African studies,
yes,
at the University of Arizona. And he later, after that, came here to begin a PhD program in the Department of Languages and Cultures of Asia. He took a break for a while to begin a career with the Department of Defense, and he's currently stationed in Ankara, Turkey. And he later on was a fortunate guinea pig who was the guinea pig who got funding to come back and complete his program for years. So he had a very intense year of working on finishing up his coursework and getting ready for prelims and everything. And the past couple of years, he's been working on his dissertation, which is kind of an ethnography of 19th century Central Asian Sufism based on indigenous sources and also on traveler accounts, which have been practically not utilized at all until now. So the description for the talk is that, so with a few notable exceptions, the study of Central Asian Sufism in the 19th century is relatively underdeveloped. Though scholars have done much to demonstrate the role of Sufis in the social, cultural, economic, and political life of the region in this period, no attempt to provide a comprehensive picture of what Sufism looked like has yet been undertaken. This talk will illuminate parts of that picture, providing glimpses of Sufi dress, connection to shrines, and their place in local folk culture. So without any further delay, please join me in welcoming Jack Rowe to talk about and Dunkin's.
Thank you. My thanks to Eli and to Jennifer for allowing me to come back. Madison's my home away from home, and the creek is one of my homes away from home within Madison, so I'm very excited to be here. This is sort of cathartic for me, and it's a good thing to do today, tomorrow's trials with the defense of the dissertation. I wanted to do the most fun chapter for my dissertation, basically, is what I'm going to be discussing with you today. Because it's the most fun, because it's the most interesting, has the most fascinating material to work with, and I just wanted to share some of that with you. It's more exciting than the title sounds, I promise. Okay, so first of all, I just wanted to start out by giving you a very brief overview, and I'll try not to belabor it, because I don't want to take up too much time with it, but a short history of mystical Islam in Central Asia, more properly Central Eurasia. And then I'll explain what I mean, why I'm distinguishing between mystical Islam and Sufism, and then we'll move on to talking about various areas, appearance, shrine connections, folklore, and then I'll do a short conclusion. So first of all, I want to point out, because my teacher's in the room, this date is incorrect. This should be 7th century, not 6th, so just forget that 6th is there. One thing that doesn't get, often is forgotten when we talk about Central Asia, because Central Asia is usually perceived as such a, you know, an integral part of the Islamic heartland. We forget, you know, the many centuries of pre-Islamic religious practice and activity in the region. And it was incredibly complex. If you think about Central Asia and the Silk Road and sort of it being a nexus of East Asian, South Asian, Middle Eastern, and, you know, by extension, Western culture, it's not only that, it also has its own indigenous traditions, but anywhere you would have commerce and interaction of cultures, you also had, you know, religious interaction. And so pre-Islamic Central Asia, you had Mahayana Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, particularly Nestorian Christianity, and Manichaeism. And then there are the indigenous religious traditions in Central Asia, including Zoroastrianism, which according to some research was born on the Kazakh steppes, and then also animism and the role of shamans, the regional variant of shaman played in that tradition. Islam came to Central Asia in the 7th century. It didn't come, let's say Muslims came to Central Asia in the 7th century, specifically the armies of the Caliph Uthman were pursuing the last emperor of the Sasanian Empire, Yazdegerd III, into what is today modern Turkmenistan, and that is when Islam first came. For some years and into the 8th century, there were mostly raids by the armies of the Caliph into the region, but between 705 and 715, Bukhara, Samarkand, and Khwarizm were all conquered by the armies of the Caliph. Mosques began to be built, and naturally people began to convert to Islam. Of course, this is a whole can of worms in itself. Why did people convert? Well, certainly people converted for, you know, reasons of piety. Other people wanted to maintain positions of power, you know, in the provincial administration. Others saw the advantage of converting to Islam because the transcontinental commodity exchange roads were increasingly coming under the control of Muslim traders. And so you had the dichotomy that's always talked about, settled Central Asia and the steppes. And so you had the process of Islamization occurring in both. And we see a lot of discussions of these sort of amorphous Muslim mystics at this time. We'll talk about the difference between mystics and Sufis and their role in the steppes in converting Turkic nomads to Islam. And one of the things that is discussed is that they used sort of syncretism and fostering a popular Islam to ease the conversion of the Turkic nomads into Islam. One of these early mystics is an individual, Shakik al-Balkhi. See there, he died fighting non-Muslim Turkic peoples in Central Asia in 810. He was sort of a warrior ascetic, which if you look at mystical Islam from the early days post the Prophet up until really 12th to 14th centuries, there's all these variants of mystical Islam, and he followed the warrior ascetic path, which I always think of as sort of the Eastern analog of maybe the Knights Templar or something of that sort, an order of chivalry who's engaging in combat and so forth, but with a religious purpose. He actually left a systematic approach to asceticism behind him. And that's really, when we talk about Sufism, we'll talk about the systematic approach. Another important early mystic in the region, Al-Halaj, who was famously executed in Baghdad in the 10th century, but he traveled throughout Turkestan. He absorbed influences from the religions that were present there, as well as Western traditions. And after his execution, some of his disciples then escaped into Khorasan and Central Asia. And Khorasan, for my purposes, is really bits of southern Turkmenistan, what is today southern Turkmenistan, northwestern Afghanistan, and then northeastern Iran. Another famous early mystic, Ibn Karam of Seistan, he's important because he had an organization. And that organization had an ethos which included, you know, wearing a sheepskin and a pointed hat, teaching, you know, Islam and mystical Islam among sort of the outcasts of society. And so this group, the Karamiya, had this as its ethos. Outward asceticism was important to them, preaching among societal outcasts. And they developed the first Hanukkahs. And now Hanukkah is a lodge, a Sufi lodge, which is an institution that gets passed on. Obviously not Sufis at this time, but passed on. So when the actual Sufi tradition developed, it was absorbed into that tradition. Another important organization we should mention are the Malamatya. sort of the more sober version of counterpart to the Caramilla. They were against public displays of asceticism, against begging, against engaging in ascetic activity in public. And I bring these two things up because we're going to be talking about Naqshbandiya and the Calendaria, specifically when we get to the 19th century, and those are the sort of tensions you see between those two groups. Time passes in Central Asia. Samanid dynasty from the early 9th century into the 11th century. You see Bukhara as their capital becoming a hub of mystical Islam. The Qarqanid dynasty, 10th century into the early 13th century, is the first Muslim Turkic polity who were converted to Islam by mystics. The Seljuk period, basically from the mid-11th century into the almost the end of the 12th century. The Seljuk period witnessed the real institutionalization of mystical Islam into the Sufi path. And some of the things that became institutionalized were orders, you know, a specific order with its own associated rituals and rules, silsilas, spiritual genealogies of Sufi masters. So you could say, I was taught by this master, who was taught by this master, so on and so forth, laying out a genealogy. Rituals such as hawa, which is spiritual seclusion, zikr, the recollection of God, which is the chief Sufi ritual, all got their, you know, finalized forms, so to speak, in this era, or began to be institutionalized. And the difference between mystical Islam writ large and Sufism is this. Sufism was originally the Iraqi variant of mystical Islam. So you had, you know, you had the warrior ascetics, you had more ascetic groups, you had people more interested in other kinds of piety, other means of achieving this relationship with deity. But the Iraqi variant, the Sufi variant, its main purpose was it laid out a systematic path by following which you would be able to achieve unity, mystical unity with deity, which is frequently, you know, if you look at mysticism across religious traditions, that's frequently, you know, the basic definition of mysticism, this unity with deity. And so the result of centuries of development consolidated between the 10th and the 12th centuries, the Iraqi brand of Islamic mysticism triumphed over the others. It absorbed influences from various other traditions that we've talked about, like Karamiya, for example, and then it became the mystical Islamic tradition, so much so that today we don't really say mystical Islam, we say Sufism, and everybody knows what we're talking about. The 13th century, very important. In Central Asia, the Mongol conquests, Mongols came, much destruction, but like their Turkic forebears before they converted to Islam, the Mongols became extended patronage to Sufi sheikhs. They eventually were Islamized. And near the end of the 14th century in Central Asia, you have the development and the rise of the Central Asian orders. There are three important indigenous Sufi orders in Central Asia, the Kubrawiya, Yasaviya, Naqshbandiya. Naqshbandiya absorbed the other two by the time we're going to be discussing, certainly by the 19th century. The Calendaria, an important order in the 19th century in Central Asia, but it's not indigenous to Central Asia. Actually came from Damascus and was transplanted there. But when I look in my sources, the two orders I see mentioned most are Naqshbandiya and Calendaria. It's fascinating because they have some similarities, but they're sort of on either end of the Sufi spectrum, which makes them very interesting to look at and to sort of compare and contrast. So just briefly, what's the difference between the new Naqshbandiya, still today one of the most widespread, most vibrant Sufi orders, not only in its Central Asian homeland, but in Turkey, in the Middle East, in Africa, in Europe, in Southeast Asia, in South Asia, in the Caucasus, still important. I hate to, you know, paint with such broad brush strokes and you know, boil it down to very few essentials, but if you think about the Naqshbandiya, usually what you think of is a couple principles. Number one, silent dhikr, or zikr, that's the recollection of God, that primary Sufi ritual conducted silently, not vocally. That's one of the hallmarks of the Naqshbandiya. Generally speaking, that's what people think of when they think of Naqshbandiya. Also, the Naqshbandiya order placed heavy emphasis on sort of normal participation in social life, having a job, having a family, not being ostentatious in their display of their spiritual powers or their spiritual state, being a functioning member of society, which is comes from the principle Hawat Dat Enjamin, solitude in the crowd. If we think about the Kalandarya, what are their hallmarks? Well, Kalandarya is just one manifestation of Dervish piety, which came about between 1200 and 1500, and really started out from Sufism and as a way of rejecting Sufism, rejecting Islamic society as a whole, as sinful, corrupt. We can do it better. We can achieve this closer relationship with deity by doing such things as being very ostentatious in our show of asceticism, being mendicants, itinerants. Being celibate. Engaged in self-mortification, and then a whole host of antinomian activities such as public nudity, shunning of married life and employment, use of intoxicants, ignoring prayers and fasting. And really, by doing this, they were saying, hey, doing these five daily prayers, this is just, you're being fettered by this, you're not spiritual enough to transcend these sort of mundane things. And so Kalandarya went through its own development, really started to turn into Sufi-like orders in the 13th century, and then by the 16th century, Kalandarya and Dervish piety in general either got absorbed into different Sufi orders, including Naqshbandiya in Central Asia, or became its own orders, such as the Bektashiya in the Ottoman Empire. Other hallmarks of Kalandarya: they survived by begging, and really, a very stark contrast to the Naqshbandiya, as opposed to having, being gainfully employed, wandering nude, and looking for a handout. And so, moving on to, actually talking about what we see in the 19th century sources. What did they actually look like, these people? Well, as Uli said, one of the sources I've been using for my dissertation are 19th century European travel accounts, which come with their own baggage, but it's interesting because to them, everything is sort of new, it's fresh, and so they're recording all kinds of details that someone in the culture would probably be like, that's those guys. So it's a different kind of perspective. And one of the things you see, for example, Count Paulin, a Russian bureaucrat who came to Central Asia really in the early 20th century, but he is investigating the uprising in Andijan in 1898. He described he was talking about a group of learned mullahs, scholars who he had brought together, and he was horrified to find out that there were Ishans, which is the regional variant or name for a Sufi sheikh or peer, Sufi master. He was horrified to find out that among this group of learned scholars, there were Ishans, and he couldn't tell the difference. For him, he wanted to be able to, like, okay, this guy's an Ishan, I can clearly tell by looking at him. This guy's not. But what he discovered and what he said was, they all look the same. They look like, proper scholars, proper upper-class gentlemen, so to speak. He described them as wearing the halat, or the ton, which is, an Uzbek robe, just the way any other scholar would. Another traveler, Ole Olofsson, a Danish explorer, he basically spent a whole page in one of his descriptions talking about Kalandarya, these wild guys that dressed this way and that, and at the end he just said, basically to describe the Naqshbandiya, they are the proper upper class of Wahara. They dress decently and they're not out of the ordinary. However, in a Manaqib I Dochi Ishan, which is a hagiography of the Naqshbandi sheikh who led the 1898 uprising against the Russians in the Fergana Valley, which is my native source for my dissertation, we have a description of the sheikh Dochi Ishan. He is described as wearing a felt jacket, a dopa, which is an embroidered skull cap you see all over Central Asia, and an old halat, And this is what's interesting. There's a fascinating story where he was actually called to come, you know, present himself for the Russian authorities in the city of Fergana. So he goes, he's wearing an old halat, and in the story it's told, you know, the person who's relaying the story says, you know, he had this habit of wearing his old robe, riding his donkey. And when he gets to town, one of the Russian guards says to him, you know, who are you? What are you doing here? He thought he was some sort of bum or troublemaker, not sure who he was. And some of the locals actually had to come to his defense and said, no, this guy's a Nishan. He's a great, you know, a great Sufi master. And the Russian said, you're lying to me. You know, I know what Nishans look like, and this is not a Nishan, which tells you volumes about, you know, Nishan's place in society, how they should appear, so on and so forth. And what this tells me is that in Central Asian society at the time, and among even among the Naqshbandiya, there were two different schools of thought, at least, as to how a Nishan should appear. You know, a Naqshbandi sheikh should appear. There were clearly those who thought, you know, you should be, you know, dressed like a wealthy upper-class member of society, and then there were those who thought their appearance should demonstrate their spiritual state. And if you remember what I said a few moments ago, Naqshbandi were against, you know, one of the original principles was against ostentatious shows of spiritual states, or, you know, look at me, I'm a great ascetic, which is essentially sort of what Dokchi Shan was doing here by wearing an old robe. He was displaying his humility, his piety, so on and so forth. Moving on to the Kalandaria. Kalandars, often known for wearing conical caps and rags, really. Eugene Schuyler, who was an American diplomat who traveled in Central Asia in the 1870s, talked about how he visited a Kalandar institution, and he described them as wearing their oldest robe of robes of rags and their high conical caps. If you know, actually, I have several pictures. We should get to that. Well, no. We'll say that. That was just a foretaste of the excitement to come. Another traveler, Sven Hedin, from Sweden, described and drew a couple sketches, and I'll show you those in a minute. Dervishes or kalandars clothed in rags, you know. Vomberi, Arminius Vomberi, a Hungarian Orientalist who also traveled in the region in the 1860s, described, and he actually disguised himself as a kalandar, and he described his clothing when he was dressed in that fashion as wearing a conical cap, or a dervish or fool's cap, as he described it. The most detailed description we have of what a kalandar looked like at that time comes from Ole Olafsson. And if you saw the picture, the image that came with the announcement for my talk, it had a picture from Olafsson on it, which he brought back, and he labeled it the original kalandar dress from Bukhara. And what that contained was, you know, usually a pointed cap made of camel wool, a kalabash, which is, you know, a dried gourd or pumpkin that they hung over their shoulder, used to collect offerings in when they would go begging door to door. And they would usually carry some sort of defensive implement, an axe, an iron spear, and a stick with rings made of bone on it to be used as a tambourine, and possibly had some symbolic meaning as well. But the conical cap is really the key element. How we know they're a kalandar? Well, they had a conical cap. There was a 16th century French travelogue describing kalandars in the Ottoman Empire, and included in that was a sort of a woodcut showing, you know, what a kalandar looked like. And at the time, it was, you know, someone with this conical cap on. And the interesting thing is to compare that image from, say, the 16th century and then in the 19th century. What's the difference between kalandar appearance then and, you know, 300 years later? Well, the main difference is, remember I talked about originally some of the kalandar ethos was, you know, celibacy, renunciation, public asceticism, public nudity, so on and so forth. Well, if we look at the images we see of kalandars in the 19th century, it is largely people who are clothed. They're wearing, you know, they still have the conical cap, but they're wearing, you know, undergarments. They have footwear on. They have not shaved off their mustache, their eyebrows, and their hair, as was an early practice of the kalandars. That said, I also have in some of my sources a description of what is referred to as just dervish, and just plainly dervish. And there are people who essentially wear like a panther skin or a bear skin, some sort of animal hide, and they had their hair shaved, their eyebrows shaved, actually a couple of variants. Some of them had long flowing hair, others had no hair, but the common theme was essentially the only things they owned were this animal skin they were wearing, except for which they were completely naked, and they had some sort of defensive implement like a hatchet or a club. And so it seems within the dervishes, within dervish piety, it's hard to judge whether there was a direct relationship between the Qalandars and then these so-called dervishes. But what it looks like is this early idea of asceticism, of completely abandoning clothing and the itinerancy, celibacy, so on and so forth, that early, what was referred to by Ahmed Kar Mustafa, who's written extensively on dervishes, he referred to them as ascetic virtuosi, so someone who took their asceticism to the extreme. It would appear that strain of dervish piety existed into the 19th century. At the same time, you had dervishes who were putting on clothes, who were becoming more like the proper upper class of Bukhara to some extent. And just a few pictures. So I took this in Tashkent long ago. But, tone, really, when I think of tone, it just means various types of robes, but this is not really a halat, I would say this is more like a chapon, but this is a traditional type of robe you would see in Uzbekistan. So you could picture a dochishon riding that and wearing sort of a ratty old version of that riding his donkey. And here's dolpa, which is the traditional Uzbek embroidered skull cap you'll see. I think I was on the same trip. I took that in Samarkand. Here is what was in the announcement for my talk. This is what Olafsson brought back with him as an example of what the Qalandar wore. You can see there's a spear here, defensive implement. You see a gourd probably for carrying water, and then you have this one here for receiving offerings. You have the pointed cap. And this, I didn't even realize I had taken this. I think I took this picture 5 years ago, maybe, in Bukhara, and I was just looking through my pictures and found it. How exciting. You see the begging bowl here, you see, a club. And so both of these are from Bukhara. It's interesting, if you're going out of your way to demonstrate your asceticism, your piety, your humility, and yet you have all this, pretty intricate embroidery on your clothing. That sort of tells you something, that they've moved beyond this notion of we have to, absolutely have no, frills about our life to, having, I guess, if you could describe embroidery on your sort of monk's habit as a frill. That's what it is. Here's another picture from Olafsson. These are Qalandars from Bukhara. And if you look at them, these guys are clearly not naked under their robes. They also have facial hair. Can't really tell if they've shaved their heads, but they have boots on. So they move beyond this more extreme asceticism. These are the sketches from Hedin, and they're both from Turkestan this says East Turkestan, this is Turkestan, but I believe this is also from Xinjiang, East Turkestan, if I remember correctly. You see this guy has a beard, he has the pointed cap on. This one's a little different. He does not have the Qalandar pointed cap. Not really sure if he fits into the Qalandar scheme, but this fellow on the right clearly does. And this is an image that came with in the Arminius Bamberi's his book about his travels and explorations in Central Asia in the 1860s. And these are dervishes of Bukhara. You see them having the cap. They have some sort of staff. They have their kalabash or their dry gourd to receive offerings. These are some pictures I just took recently in Hacı Bektaş, which is sort of southeast of Ankara in Turkey. And the Bektaşi, if you remember, were one of the orders that developed a dervish way of thinking. And if you go to Haji Bektash today, you can see, you know, a begging bowl, and then you see these sort of defensive implements that the Bektashis used to carry around with them as they traveled. And, you know, I guess if you're traveling, you know, the back country of Anatolia, you want to be carrying, especially at that time with wolves and whatnot, you want to be carrying your defensive implement with you. All right, now on to the feasts. Shrine pilgrimage, incredibly important in Central Asia, still to this day, important part of Muslim life. The goals of going to shrines and participating in shrine pilgrimage usually center around, you know, freedom from infertility or other illness, or, you know, seeking a male child in a family because of the importance of a male child, or you want prosperity and sort of some sort of social or economic venture. But what makes a place sacred? It's an interesting question. People have tried to quantify, you know, why are people visiting this place over another? Usually at these places in Central Asia, you will find caves, rocks of unusual shapes, rock formations, healing springs, trees, and so forth. And that in combination with the burial place of a saint. And what makes a saint? Soviet ethnographer Snesaryev sort of tried to quantify who these folks were that were buried in saints' tombs, and he came up with a list. Personages of vague identity, don't really know who they are, but they're said to be pious, and they usually lack proper names, they don't have biographies, but they're associated with the early history of Islam in the region. And then you also had medieval Sufis whose tombs became places of pilgrimage, and also the tombs of local rulers who were not, you know, religious people per se, you know, that wasn't their vocation, but their tombs became places of pilgrimage out of inertia, he said. So, you know, somebody's buried in a spot, people start going there, pretty soon it's like, hey, this must be a good place to receive the blessing of a saint, let's go there as well. And that's really the crux of the why different individuals over time wanted to be involved with administering shrines, because you have pilgrimage to the shrine, you have people spending money at the shrines, and you could parlay the money you receive from pilgrims, as well as just the significance of your saint's biography and so forth, into political power. And we see that at the Alid Shrine in Balkh in northern Afghanistan. But discussing, sort of looking at it academically, what role this shrine pilgrimage played in Sufism. Older scholarship on the subject usually refers to shrine pilgrimage derisively. Talks about a cult of saints. Talks about, you know, decadence of Sufism, how post-classical Sufism, you know, slowly degenerated into, instead of being trained by a Sufi master for, you know, you yourself to know how to reach closer to deity, instead you just go down to the shrine, throw a few coins in, you know, receptacle and ask the saint for a blessing, rather than going through these, you know, various spiritual exertions yourself to achieve the blessing. And the older scholarship talks a lot about baraka, the saint's charisma, the saint's power, and going to the shrine to obtain that baraka. I think a more useful way to look at it is something that has come about because of a scholar named Arthur Buehler, and he proposed the mediating sheikh. And what he meant by that was he described, he works on South Asia and in colonial era India, the mediating sheikh was someone who can administer the shrine, control the shrine, and he acted as an intermediary with deity on the behalf of those who came to worship at his shrine. And it was a way really to appeal to, let's say, rural folks who really their only experience with, an Islamic institution may have been either the village mosque or to go to a shrine, whereas, you know, people in the city had madrasas and so on and so forth that they could participate in. I just want to discuss a couple different shrines that we see in the traveler accounts. The Kizilhar Shrine is interesting. Sven Hedin, again, the Swede, discussed this. It was on a mountain pass between what is now Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. He described it as a burial cairn of the Mohammedan saint Kizilhart, which consisted of a mound of stones decorated with the religious offerings of pious curies, namely tubs, which is a stick. He describes it as a stick with a rag tied around it, a piece of cloth, so on and so forth. And I'll get back to sort of comparing this with the other shrine we're going to be talking about. The other is the tomb of Zengi Ata, which is outside Tashkent. Eugene Schuyler described this as a very shabby suburban shrine, and he made some comments that linked it somewhat with the shrine of Kizilard. He described it as having ram's horns and long bits of dirty rag, which every pilgrim had felt it a necessity to tie there on some stick or tree. Though he did say nearby there was a fine garden with orchards, ponds, and canals, and madrasas, and that's why people actually came. According to him, nobody really cared about the shrine. Moving on, another shrine in what is now Xinjiang in the People's Republic of China. Heading described the shrine of Ordon Pacha, which was in the desert. And it had a hongkah associated with it, so a Sufi lodge had a kazan hane, or a cauldron house, where pilgrims would bring their offerings and they would have sort of communal feasts together. And also, he described it as having a grave mound decorated with tubs, once again, those sort of pennants on the end of a stick, a bit of rag. And also had a tomb and a sacred spring. Now, this is all fine and interesting, but what does it have to do with Sufism? How can we link the two together? One way to think about it is to think about the role Sufis could have played or played as administrators of shrines. The problem is, by the time of the 19th century, it's not always clear who these folks administering the shrines, if they're actual Sufis, are they members of an order, are they learning, are they participating in rituals, are they just descendants of famous Sufis of the past, which is a phenomenon we see prevalent in Central Asia. I mean, Sufis were administering waqfs or pious endowments, which then, you know, pay for the building of shrines, of hongkahs, of madrasas, and so on and so forth. They were acting as the administrators of waqfs from the 13th century forward. In fact, if you go to Samarkand today, you see the tomb complex of Hoxha Ahrar, who was an important 15th century Naqshbandi sheikh. And Joanne Gross has done some interesting work on that complex in the 19th century, where his descendants, people who claimed literal descent from him, were still administering the shrine, you know, 400 years later. Once again, are these people Sufis? Does it make you a Sufi if your ancestor of 400 years ago was a Sufi? It's an interesting question to ask, and I don't have an excellent answer for it. Does it mean that those people weren't involved in Sufi rituals in pursuing the goals of Sufism? We see this phenomenon brought up in my sources. If you look at Alexander Burns, a British spy and explorer, when he was in the Emirate of Bukhara, he actually went to the tomb complex of Baha al-Din Naqshband, which is, you know, still today outside of Bukhara. And he met the administrator of the shrine, and the administrator claimed to be a descendant of Naqshband. And once again, didn't describe, is this person a part of the Sufi order? Is he just, you know, a descendant or a claimed descendant of the person buried in the tomb? Moving on a little bit, what sort of rituals do we see going on at these tombs in the 19th century, and can that help us tie them to Sufism? The sorts of rituals that usually occur at shrines are things like lighting candles, tying bits of cloth on nearby trees, which we've seen several of our sources mention, as a sort of votive offering, making animal sacrifices or other offerings. We also have in the sources festivals and feasting that occurs. For example, at Zengi Ata, that one outside Tashkent that Schuyler described, he said Tashkent was nearly deserted during the feast that took place at Zengi Ata. The only sort of properly religious behavior he saw going on at Zengi Ata during his time where there was women weeping and sort of praying at the shrine. Meanwhile, and I'm going to read this description because I love it so much. He said there were tents and booths, samovars were smoking everywhere, and all along the brook were pots where pilaf was preparing. In almost every booth, there was someone playing on the guitar and singing. Boys were constantly dancing to the music of a large native orchestra. course, I'm not going to judge whether these people were being pious enough at the shrine, but it's interesting to see, you know, what sort of activities and rituals were taking place at the shrine. By way of comparison, if we look at the shrine of Ordan Pacha in Xinjiang, Sven Hedin, during his visit, described a scene where there was, you know, thousands of pilgrims, and they greeted the sheikh, the administrator of the shrine, with wild, quote, wild howls of Allah, Allah, while the standard bearers performed a religious dance, which sounds to me like a sort of zikr, a sort of a remembrance, if a very exuberant and sort of maybe not a very focused one. Another description of sort of things that go on at shrines, Schuyler also visited the famous necropolis outside of Samarkand, the Shahi Zinda, and he described how small cloths were given as offerings to the shrines of saints. He also described a vocal dhikr, and I didn't really get into this because it's a whole other can of worms, whole other kettle of fish, but dhikr, of course, comes in two varieties, really basic varieties, the vocal dhikr and the silent dhikr. And I mentioned that Naqshbandi, one of the hallmarks is the silent dhikr, which doesn't always hold true, but generally speaking, that's what the Naqshbandi are known for, is the silent dhikr. Silent dhikr is something that really is not very exciting to watch. You can get on YouTube and watch a thousand of them, but it's more about concentration, and dhikr really involves the repeating of religious formula, repeating of the name, 99 names of God, breath control, sort of inducing a trance over time. The vocal dhikr can be much more, you know, can involve more violent bodily movement or greater physical exertions, and obviously it's you're hearing it, so it's a much different thing going on. And Schuyler described seeing a vocal dhikr at the Shahi Zinda, this necropolis outside of Samarkand. Now, if we want to look at a clear case of where we have Sufis and shrines coming together, we can find it in the Manakibi Dochi Ishan. Once again, the hagiography of the sheikh who led the 1898 revolt in Andijan. In one of the stories in the hagiography, the sheikh Dochi Ishan and his disciples go to the shrine of this deceased saint, Hoja Pacha. And they're performing a religious ritual there, a haka. And in the midst of the ritual, Dochi Shan says he sees two saints come out of the tomb, and they sort of start to lament, like, you know, it would be really nice if anybody appreciated us by instituting a feast here and, you know, reading religious formulae or, you know, over the tomb. And so Dochi Shan takes it upon himself to co-opt the shrine, basically. He and his followers construct an ashana, a kitchen for the preparation of feasts. He gets local disciples to come and read formulae over the tomb, and he starts his own shrine feast. And so to me, this says a couple things here. Clearly, this was someone that Dochi Ishan thought was suitable for co-optation. You know, he wouldn't have co-opted somebody he thought was, you know, outside the pale or beyond the pale of, you know, Naqshbandi philosophy and ethos. This was somebody that could be co-opted. Meanwhile, all the people who would normally come to that shrine suddenly are attached to him in some manner. So they're coming here and they're partaking in a feast. Naturally, someone would say, well, who would institute this feast here? And they'd say, oh, Dochi Ishan, this great sheikh from, you know, Andijan. Suddenly his stock goes up in the eyes of all those who are participating the shrine feast. Does that make him his disciples? Are any of those who come and partake of the feast, they suddenly his disciples? That's a difficult question to answer. You can certainly see why Sufis would be interested in inserting themselves into shrine pilgrimage. A couple pictures. This is actually in the Vorok enclave in Tajikistan, way up in the mountains. I was there 2011 or so, and I was there with a friend and a driver, and we just happened upon this place. It's like Ziyaret Gol of Hoja Chimurgan Baba. And you had a holy spring nearby, and the driver explained to us, you gotta get out, you gotta wash here, drink from the holy spring. And then you had a tree with, you know, there's your characteristic wish cloths. Sometimes people describe them as wish trees, you know, prayers, you know, tied to the tree. This is actually at the tomb of Bahauddin Naqshband in Qasr Arafat in Uzbekistan. It's a petrified tree, and people are circumambulating it. And I had a couple other pictures, but people were dropping money at one point on the tree. And this is an actual tog. So, you know, many of the sources were describing these sort of pennants hooked to the ends of the poles. This is one you see on the tomb of Naqshband. And there's a whole history of togs as military standards among Turkic and Mongol people, you know, stretching back centuries. This is actually in Turkey, and my wife's going to be really happy that I got her this picture. It's in Eskişehir province in Turkey, and it's a very fascinating place. I actually wrote about it in my dissertation. We just happened to be driving through there once, and I was like, I know where that place is! So we, like, of course, had to go up there and take pictures. It's a converted monastery, I believe it was like 7th century or so, an Orthodox Christian monastery that was then converted into a Dervish lodge at some point. And just outside you see, you know, wish trees, or these sort of cloth offerings hanging in the trees. This I threw in for fun. This was a trip, I was in Mongolia a few years back, and it's striking that you see, this is in central Mongolia at a monastery. You can see, you know, similar cloths tied in trees there, and this is a tradition that comes all the way from Mongolia through Central Asia into Turkey. And this, when I saw this oval, it made me think, or when I read about the Kizilar, the shrine on the Kizilar Pass that Sven Hedin described, it reminded me of the oval in Tibetan and in Buddhist culture. Sort of a pile of stones with votive offerings. Here's an actual picture from the 19th century from Sven Hedin from a shrine in Tashkent, and you can see the togs up here on top of the shrine. This is another shrine near Samarkand. It's supposedly the shrine, or reportedly the shrine, of the biblical prophet Daniel, whose remains were brought to Central Asia by Timur when he conquered Iran. And just outside the shrine, you see a tree. You can't see this very well, but there were wish cloths tied in the tree as well. This is the Shah-i Zinda in Samarkand, that necropolis outside the city where various offerings are made. And still there's plenty of pilgrims there to this day. I love this sign when I saw it. I don't know how long the government of Uzbekistan's been doing this, or if this is a Soviet holdover. But if you look at the rules, these are the rules you should follow as a pilgrim visiting the place. It is a sin during the visit to the mausoleum to beg saints for help or to make a sacrifice. Now, if you recall, one of the main points of shrine pilgrimage has always been to do just that. You go there because you want help with a problem. It is a sin to take a photo near the graves and also write various words and wishes. Write on a piece of paper and leave on the saint's tomb. Prohibited cooking, having a rest, listening to music. It sounds very much like what was going on at Zangiata's tomb in the time of Schuyler when he visited in the 1870s. So it's fascinating because when coming into the holy place, it's necessary to greet the deceased and to worship them by reading the Quran. So it's telling you to come in and participate in shrine pilgrimage, and then it's like, oh yes, but you can't do it this way. Anyway, that was more for fun. On to the donkey's tomb, on the folklore. The Menakibi Dokchi Shan is a type of folklore because really what it is, like all good hagiographies, is a story where somebody you trust, an older member of the order, you know, a trusted and respected Sufi, says, hey, you know what? One time I was with our peer and he did this amazing thing. So it's a trusted person. And he's talking about supernormal events, but occurring in a geography you're familiar with. Like, hey, you know this room in the Hanukkah? Well, this amazing thing happened there. And so it makes the supernormal event, it grounds it in geography and history. And it validates the legend by doing so. But to talk about some specific fun folklore stories, One of those is the story of Kizilart, which we talked about with Sven Hedin. He was told by his interlocutors, his native guides, that Kizilart actually had come to Central Asia from the Middle East, presumably during the time of the Prophet Muhammad, and had propagated Islam among the non-Islamic peoples of Central Asia at the time. And one of the great things he did was he discovered this pass in the mountains between Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. Because he discovered it, his blessing was upon it, that made it possible to cross back and forth between these two regions using the pass. And the legend goes on that he had six brothers, and they're all named something Ark, because Ark in Kyrgyz is one of the words for pass. So Kizilart, the red pass, or Muz Ark, the ice pass. And really it fulfills what is called one of the four functions of folklore. It has an etiological purpose. It explains why a natural phenomenon exists. Not that he created the pass per se, but his blessing is upon it, and therefore people are able to pass back and forth on the pass. And so you get a sense of why the people would have told stories like this and what they actually thought about Sufis. Because folklore is usually the preserve of the common people, and what are they talking about? What do they think about Sufis? Well, one of the things they think is that saints and Sufis have the power to, preserve you against, the terrors of nature. You're able to cross this icy pass because of the blessing of a Sufi. A similar story is that of Korkut Ata. Korkut Ata is a very famous figure in Turkic mythology, particularly in Central Asia, and of course in Turkey through the Book of Dedi Korkut. The story that Eugene Schuyler learned about Korkut Ata when he was traveling in Central Asia in the 19th century was that Korkut Ata was 14 feet tall. That just sort of passes without any description. Yeah, he was 14 feet tall. I want to hear more about that. Then he moves on. Korkut Ata, one night, was having a dream, and there were some guys digging a grave, and he overheard them say, "We're digging a grave for Korkut Ata." And so he thought, "Man, I got to get out of here, get far away from this place." So he moves, in a very interesting story. He moves back and forth to these different places trying to cheat death. Finally, he figures out the place to cheat death is on the Sirdarya River, and he lays down his mantle on the river. He floats on the river for a century, just playing his lute, and he's able to prolong death or put off death for a century. So what do we learn? Why are people telling this story? What do they think about Sufis and saints? Well, they have power to prolong death, if not to put it off. And it's interesting that the tomb of Korkut Ata in southern Kazakhstan is traditionally a place to go seek healing. Surely if this guy can cheat death for 100 years, I can go there and he can help me out with health problems. Finally, to the donkey's tomb. This was my favorite story I came across, and it's sort of long, but I'll just give you the 10-cent version. So Sven Hedin, when he was in Kashgar in 1890 in Xinjiang, what's Xinjiang today, he heard this story. He described, Kashgar, all these tombs in the city, and one of the stories he heard was that once there was this great sheikh who had a shrine in Kashgar, and he had a pupil there. And the pupil said, it's time for me to get on with my own life. I should get out in the world. Please give me some money so I can go forth and, develop myself. And the sheikh said, "Unfortunately, I have nothing to give you other than this donkey. Please take it. Go with God. Live long and prosper." So the young man takes the donkey. He sets out across the desert, probably the Taklamakan Desert. At some point, the donkey, dies of thirst. And so the young man is, bereft of anything in the world. The only thing he had was the donkey. And so he digs a tomb for the donkey, and he's laying there weeping on top of the tomb when some rich merchants come along, and they say, "What's your problem? Why are you so distraught?" And he says, my best friend has died. And so they say, this man's so devoted. They put forth the cash to build a tomb on top of the donkey, this magnificent structure. Years pass, the young man becomes very wealthy because of administering the money that comes through the pilgrims that come to visit his tomb. Eventually, his old sheikh comes from Kashgar because he's heard about this wondrous tomb and he wants to visit. He's surprised when he gets there to find his former pupil, administering this magnificent tomb. And he says, "Tell me truly, who is buried in this tomb?" And the pupil says, "It is only the donkey you gave me. Now you tell me who was the saint that reposed where you used to teach me. And then the sheikh replied, it was the father of your donkey. So what's the purpose of this story? Somebody is obviously having a poke at, you know, shrine administrators and various shrines in Kashgar. You know, you could say that they were, whoever was telling the story was generally, you know, not favorably disposed towards Sufis, towards shrine administrators, and they were saying, these people are frauds, they're telling you there's a great saint there, it's really a donkey. But generally speaking, folklore is not of a revolutionary bent of mind, but it's a more conservative way of looking at things or preserving conservative traditions. So I would suggest what the story tells us is, you know, they're not trying to throw out the whole tradition of shrine pilgrimage whole cloth. They're just probably trying to poke fun at, you know, hey, that guy's tomb over there, that's fake. Our tomb here in our shrine, wonderful, please come here. So what do we learn from all this? I would say that for the Sufi, going back to appearance, clothes were not merely a matter of fashion. They were a way of, you know, displaying identity markers. It advertised the Sufi's order affiliation, his spiritual state. If I was wearing standing here today wearing my conical cap, you would now know that I was a Kalandar. A little more difficult to describe in terms of Naqshbandiya because, you know, as discussed, generally speaking, they looked like any other wealthy, well-to-do member of the upper class. However, their, you know, refinement of their clothes was in itself somewhat of a way of displaying, you know, their spiritual power. Ah, these are great saints. Obviously, they're wealthy, they're well-to-do. You know, they've been blessed by God. In a like manner, journeying to and performing rituals at a sacred shrine was a way, as an identity marker. If I went to a certain saint shrine and participated in the pilgrimage, even if I wasn't a direct disciple of that saint, I've linked myself with him somehow. And whoever is administering that shrine, whether they be a Sufi or not, now I'm linked with them, and that's another marker of that Sufi order's identity. And by co-opting shrines, you could obviously increase the size of your organization. You know, if I put a shrine in an area where I don't have a presence, suddenly I have disciples, I have members of my organization, so to speak, in that area as well. And just as visiting tombs of saints was usually the preserve of the common people, the majority of those associated with Sufi orders in this time period, their folklore reveals much about their own goals and aspirations for participating in visiting shrines and being part of the orders. You know, they're seeking that barakah, that blessing, charisma of the saints, because as we learn from those stories, the saints have power over death, they have power over nature. And that is it.
You mentioned hatchet. Mm-hmm. I imagine that the word used is balta.
Yes.
Valid from Mongolia all the way to Hungary.
It's funny. The only reason the word hatchet came to mind is because one of the travelers had said hatchet, which, I mean, who was that? And, no, that was Olofsson. I was like, that sounds similar to American would say. I don't know why.
You have this picture there of these colored handkerchiefs hanging there. Reminds me I've seen on mountain passes in Tibet.
Yes, I think it's very similar. In fact, interestingly enough, I was watching a BBC documentary on the Celts from the 80s a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago. And it was showing pilgrimage to shrines in Ireland in the 80s. I don't know if that's still similar now. But people were tying cloths to trees around uh-huh. the shrine. So this is obviously a complex of religious rituals which stretches from, you know, probably Manchuria into, you know, the British Isles.
All the way to Ireland.
Yeah. Which I was just blown away when I saw that. Sorry. Which move?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I was going to ask, I was interested in the use of the term saint. Is that a very advanced concept in Islam? I wasn't aware that it was.
Saint is something that, you know, when people first started saying Sufism, you know, Orientalist Westerners, I think it was an easy way to describe it. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, it's, if you know, you know, just basic things about, you know, the role of saints in Roman Catholicism, for example, you could see, well, it seems like an easy analogy to make. We have saints, they have saints. The word that's often used is awliya, the Arabic word, friends of God. Mm-hmm. And so you would, some people, I think, don't like to use the word saint because, like, we're trying to, you know, import a Western concept into Islam that doesn't really make sense, but people still continue to use it. And frankly, there's so much packaged inside of saint, it's hard to think of another word to use that conveys as much meaning. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, let's get rid of one word and then use a paragraph to say the same amount of information.
Because I noticed the word was used on that list of rules they showed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can I make a footnote on that?
Yes.
So, many years ago, Eliyahu Karim also gave a talk here, and he talked about these kinds of prohibitions. And it's also similar in Turkey. And, you know, he argued, and I think rightly, that this is kind of like late 19th, early 20th century Salafi influence that then carried over into Soviet religious or spiritual boards in the Soviet times and also in Turkey. So, you know, the notion of saint is something that, let's say, you know, you're very, let's say, puritanical or very orthodox Sunni Muslims would not accept at all. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, and that's, you know, that's why, like, groups that are involved, you know, like, I don't want to talk about Islamic State as Sunni and Orthodox, that's a whole different problem. But, you know, they destroy those shrines, and they, you know, it's rejected. And then, like, in Saudi Arabia, they eliminate all kinds of buildings that can be involved with any, as associated with worshipping somehow earlier ancestors.
I mean, the Wahhabis even destroyed the tomb of the Prophet. Century, if I remember correctly. And the thing that fascinated me about that shrine was, I think Eli is exactly correct, it's, there's this tension, and especially in the 19th century, when really a lot of members of Sufi orders started to move beyond the order and look at becoming modernists, you know, i.e. Western in some way, more politically active, you know, more socially active, so on and so forth. And they looked at these older practices, shrine pilgrimage and so forth, as examples of backwardness. And not only backwardness, but it came to have, you know, negative religious connotations as well. Like, oh, these people are essentially pagans, they're going to these shrines, therefore, you know, they're not real Muslims. The interesting thing to me is that today, the emphasis in Uzbekistan, especially, for example, is let's get completely away from Salafism. We want nothing to do with these guys who may or may not be associated with Osama bin Laden types or Islamic States. And yet, they're sort of closing down the one, you know, avenue that the people have to express themselves in terms of their public piety, going to a shrine. You know, usually, as I said, there's this dichotomy between, you know, the Salafist mindset and then the Sufi mindset, and, you know, going to shrines is okay on that side, it's not okay over here. And you don't want your citizens to be Salafis, but then you're saying, oh, well, don't go to shrines either. It's like, well, what do you want them to do? I mean, choose one or the other. I'm sorry, ready?
Actually, that's kind of my question, was that early Christianity with those saints that you mentioned had the exact same problem with the Roman, like the old, more stoic and stoic-minded Christian having a problem with what they saw as like the pagan-esque rituals surrounding St. Felix and a lot of the North African martyrs. Mm-hmm. So I was curious about, like, with regards to, like, the fable, like, the moral of the fable, like, were there movements in, like, before maybe Salafism, like, movements against these shrines in Central Asia, or, like, a more abstract or philosophical Islam?
I mean, I think there's always been detractors of, I shouldn't say detractor, I mean, trying to put a value judgment on it. There's always been those within Islam, I think, who didn't agree with shrine pilgrimage, and they looked on it as, you know, and I think the little I've read about similar problems in the Roman Empire and so forth, it's sort of seen as, this is something the rabble does, this is the masses, it's popular religion, it's not real religion, it's them out, you know, having their feasts, not really doing anything pious, but they're having a, you know, a party at a tomb, and you have, you know, people in that proper upper class are saying real religion includes, you know, saying your prayers, doing this, doing that, not just going out and dropping an offering in a tomb. And so I think there's always been that tension in Islam, but it obviously increased from the 19th century into the 20th century, and then, for example, got folded into Soviet practice, which has been pushed on into Uzbekistan today, which really hasn't changed much since Soviet times in terms of its religious policy. So I think that modernist thinking, looking back at Sufism and shrine pilgrimage and so forth as backwards and, you know, this old-timey stuff that we need to get rid of and move on to a more enlightened era.
So to what extent have you seen in your research that some of these shrines existed as shamanist or pagan holy sites prior to the arrival of Islam?
You know, I haven't seen, it's interesting, I haven't seen that much scholarship discussing that phenomenon in Central Asia, but in the Balkans, people are always discussing it.
Right.
Like, clearly this was a pagan shrine, which then became a Christian shrine, which then became a Muslim shrine at some point. And the only difference is that you're changing the symbol, whether it's a crescent or a cross or whatever it is on top of the, you know, the tomb. I'm sure that same phenomenon exists in Central Asia.
Well, the reason I ask is in Mongolia and Buryatia, a lot of those sites that you even had pictures of are combining, you know, the stone stacked on top of each other. That's a shamanist.
Exactly.
Holy sign, and then you're bringing in the ribbons, which is a more of a traditionally Tibetan Buddhist sign. So.
It's certainly there, and if one of the things I didn't get into, but in the hagiography in the Menachemi Dokchiashan actually goes to a village to build a mosque on behalf of these nomadic Kyrgyz. And one of the things he does in order to build this mosque is he destroys an old shrine. It's the one place in the village where there's trees allowed to grow, because there's a sacred spring there, and the Kyrgyz disciples are like, please don't cut this down, we used to worship this saint, you know, our fathers did, and he said, you know, I'm going to show you what kind of a saint you have here. He lives in this filthy stream. You know, he clears out the wood. He builds a house, you know, a pool for doing ablutions and so forth, and transforms what was a pagan shrine, not into another shrine, Islamic shrine, but as a part of an Islamic institution, because he repurposes the wood to build a mosque and so forth. So I think that's emblematic of probably a process that happens all over Central Asia, though I haven't seen that much discussion of it.
I was interested in what you're saying about the role of nakedness, because stereotypically you think of that as being diametrically opposed to the precepts of Islam. For example, in the list of rules you showed, it stressed the importance of wearing appropriate attire.
And that's the exact point. The Dervish way of thinking was, we're going to reject society. We don't need society. In fact, society is full of too many snares. You have people wanting to make money, to look good to their neighbors, to move up the social ladder. We're going to get completely rid of that. We're going to reduce life to the most basic elements, which is me wandering around in a panther skin, you know, and roaming from place to place.
So, like, as a corollary to that, there was some stuff about how Socrates and Diogenes in some of the early Islamic tradition get merged together. And Diogenes preached a lot of the same ideas. Now, is this developing independently as like just a rejection of wealth, or would they possibly be deriving from the same tradition?
Who knows? I mean, you could make a case for either, and there's plenty of people who've said, ah, Sufism, of course, it develops in its very Islamic tradition, has, you know, all these various Islamic documents and so forth to back it up, you know, traditions, but then you also have people saying, how do you see the influence of Neoplatonism, Gnosticism, so on and so forth. So my own personal opinion is it's all there to some degree or another, depending on which order you're talking about.
Your audience has been, you know, just in totally enthralled.
Assaulted.
No, for about
really 15
minutes. I think since I'm going to have to catch a bus, and others probably will too, so I'd just like to say that, you know, some of this is clearly like universal or really, really ancient. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at like a Tuvan village, you kind of imagine that it looks like it's Native American or something, and you know, you think of flags and so on, and probably there's Native American elements like that too. this kind of mendicant behavior and so on, practices I think exist in Jainism.
Yes.
As well. Yeah. These are things that, you know, even are like probably really, really ancient, and they just became formalized later on in various orders. I mean, what would you say about that?
Just as you said that, I thought about how Vihara, supposedly one of the etymologies is Vihara, the ancient, you know, the Buddhist temple in Vihara. It's hard because people try to bring ideology in it. You have people who are, I'm not going to name names, great scholars who I admire very much, but who say things like, oh, no, Sufism is completely Islamic and we'll have no discussions of Neoplatonism and shamanism and Jainism, whatever influences. And then you have others say, hey, look at this. There's things in here that either develop independently or they're getting influence from the outside. And I certainly think there's plenty of room for outside influence. I had someone very knowledgeable about Buddhism once described to me the rosary actually came, according to their research or their knowledge, to Christianity from Buddhism. Buddhist monks who had come to Syria, you know, in the, who knows, the 5th century or something AD. And of course Muslims use the rosary. The begging bowl is an institution you see in Buddhism, you know, Buddhist monks using that. So so where did this thing start out? I don't know. But I think it shuts down real scholarship and real discussion the minute you say, oh no, Sufism is completely Islamic, we will hear no discussions of outside influence. I think it's silly to ignore the possibility that exists. And then there's clear examples of things like this, for example.
I should, before we thank you, I should just say I'm trying to keep one in each of my jackets as a kind of way of subverting the transportation, you know, the TSA, you know, going through the airports as a Muslim terrorist with Muslim prayer beads in my jacket. So please join me in thanking.